It's Tuesday, February 9th. We've only done this a few times in history, and none of them have been like this. We start here. A former president gets set to face an impeachment trial starting today.
Their argument is he didn't mean literally fight, he meant figuratively fight.
Walk you through what to expect as this unprecedented process kicks off. Half a vaccine must be better than no vaccine at all, right?
You could actually be inadvertently selecting for more mutants.
Why scientists are so concerned about giving away that second dose. And they can bury you before you even hear them coming.
You're going to have more moisture in a warmer atmosphere that can fuel more extreme snowstorms.
Now, climate scientists are asking, why are we suddenly seeing more avalanches than ever? From ABC News, this is Start Here. I'm Brad Milkey. Several states across the country have established, after thorough investigations, that there was no real fraud by voters in 2020. Maybe some individual cases, but nothing close to something that would have swayed an outcome. At least, that's when they investigated voters.
In the meantime, you're also following a breaking headline just as we're on tonight out of Georgia.
Last night, Georgia became the first state to begin an investigation of former President Donald Trump over whether he sought to illegally influence the election himself.
The people of Georgia know that this was a scam. And because of what you've done to the president, a lot of people aren't going out to vote.
In this phone call, you can hear Trump making the case that he decisively won the election in Georgia, which is not true. You can hear the Secretary of State of Georgia say, yeah, no, sorry, like, we checked all this already. You're still wrong. And then you hear Trump just get kind of frustrated.
I just want to find 11,780 votes, which is one more than we have.
Think about what you just heard there. If that was a mid-level operative for the Republican Party or the Democratic Party, you could imagine investigators having a field day with that. But the fact was, this was a sitting president of the United States. The system of consequences is sometimes a little foggier for the commander-in-chief. Well, today, we're about to see how that system of consequences works because the now former president is about to be tried for the second time in barely a year. Now, the charge here is not about voter tampering. It's not about state election boards. Starting today, the Senate's job will be to consider another question. Did the president of the United States incite an insurrection? And if he did, what should happen to him? Let's get you set up for what this is about to look like starting today. We got ABC's chief legal analyst, Dan Abrams, joining us, along with ABC's Capitol Hill producer, Trish Turner. And Trish, can you just start us off with an explainer on what is about to go down starting today? Like, how's this going to work?
So today, it won't really look like a trial as when you think of oral arguments, opening arguments. Today is going to be specifically at the very front of this trial. The senators wanted to hear a debate on this question of constitutionality. So they've allotted 4 hours, equally divided on each side. So we'll hear from the House managers, we'll hear from the Trump legal team, and they will argue the constitutionality of this trial before the senators, and then there will be another vote.
If we are about to try to impeach a president, where is the Chief Justice? If the accused is no longer president, where is the constitutional power to impeach him?
We don't know if it'll look exactly like the one over the Rand Paul motion that ended up with 45 Republicans saying this thing isn't constitutional, but that's the expected outcome at this point.
The issue upon which we already voted, I think, is an interesting constitutional question. I think we ought to listen to the lawyers argue the question.
But they wanted that official record. And then after that point, they'll move on to the trial. And that will sort of officially start on Wednesday.
Now, I understand why this fringe constitutional theory is being advanced. For the past few weeks, the political right has been searching for a safe harbor, a way to oppose the conviction of Donald Trump without passing judgment on his conduct.
Well, and so with that, let's turn to Dan Abrams. Dan, I mean, from a legal perspective, it kind of feels like this is like your day of pretrial motions, right? Is that what it is? And, you know, is it going anywhere?
Sure, it's the way to think of it. The issue is that the jurors are also the judges. So the judges make the rules. Typically in a trial, you would go to the judge and say, judge, this is what we want presented to the jury, or this is what we don't want presented to the jury. And here, that jury are the judges. So the reality is that this just comes down to numbers. There's not, you know, is it a good legal argument? Is it, do they have it? What, how strong a case do they have? you know, in the end, this is about, do they have the numbers? And it is clear the Trump team slash the Republicans do not have the numbers to dismiss this outright.
Okay, so then Trish, like, so that's today. That's kind of what we can expect. But going forward, like, what happens next? If this is a trial, that means what? There are opening statements,
opening arguments,
and witnesses, and jury deliberations. Like,
that's
when
right.
do we expect all the, you know, the courtroom stuff?
So the oral arguments will begin on Wednesday.
Donald John Trump engaged in high crimes and misdemeanors by inciting violence against the government of the United States.
That's 16 hours each side over 2 days. Senators don't want to listen to more than 8 hours a day from each of these guys. So it's 8 hours on Wednesday, 8 hours on Thursday, entirely from the House managers. They are putting on their case to the jurors, to the senators. And really interesting to note, and we made fun of this last time, you can't imagine all 100 senators, you know, in the chamber. They all have to be quiet.
These are long days for the senators. Many of them are reported to be restless. They were standing at their desks, walking around. Rand Paul had a crossword puzzle. A few of them had fidget spinners. For real.
Interestingly, in this one, though, Brad, they aren't going to all be in the chambers. Some of them are going to be spread out because of COVID. They'll be up in the galleries where the press normally sits. Some of them are even going to be in an anteroom that they've set up with a television. So a little unusual for this trial. So that's Wednesday and Thursday. Then on Friday, we get to the Trump legal team.
Dan, if it comes down to an argument on each side, like, what are those arguments going to be? And what, you're a trial guy, like, how are they going to try to prove it?
So I think you're going to see two different types of arguments. I think you're going to see the Democrats, the House managers, present a kind of moral, principled, right and wrong sort of argument. And you're going to hear the Trump team present a sort of legalistic argument. And what I mean by that is you're going to have the House managers try and tell a story.
Democrats are sifting through video like these.
Donald Trump is still our president.
Preparing to use them to make their case, the former president is singularly responsible for the violence at the Capitol.
They're going to be trying to evoke the emotion of what happened.
Rioters quickly overwhelming police and overtaking the hallowed halls.
They broke the glass. Everybody stay down. Get down.
To say, this was so serious. This was so bad. And it was his fault.
We're gathered together in the heart of our nation's capital for one very, very basic and simple reason: to save our democracy.
And you're going to see from the Trump team more of process-based arguments that it is his, within his rights to say the sorts of things that he said. Right. You're going to hear them argue that this proceeding shouldn't even be happening because he is no longer in office.
And one of his lawyers saying this to Fox News.
Can you imagine any American citizen considering it to be a trial in which the judge and jury has already announced publicly that the defendant must be convicted in this case?
It's almost as if one side won't be responding directly to the other. And I think that's going to make it both interesting and confusing at the same time.
And Trish, for the record, I mean, is there a chance that minds actually get changed because of these presentations? Like, are Republicans perhaps going to go, oh, I want to convict? Or I can't imagine Democrats will say, I'm actually going to acquit.
No, I would say to the latter. I really don't think so. I think Dan's right. But I will say, in reading the Trump team's legal brief, it was extremely combative.
They say the First Amendment entitles Trump to express his belief that the election results were suspect, claiming there is insufficient evidence to prove him wrong.
They're going down a road that's very Trumpy in this argument. And I just wonder what that might do to some Republicans in the chamber. If they're on firm ground with a lot of Republicans in their argument that this is unconstitutional, in the process argument, if they start down the road, if they veer off that road in any way, I think you get into troubled territory.
Do you go into the impeachment trial still having an open mind about the president's
conduct?
Well,
look, I want to listen to the arguments. I think that's what we ought to do.
Mitch McConnell has already said through his you know, intermediaries that he believes that President Trump committed impeachable offenses. So that tells you what you need to know. So this is a very narrow path that the Trump team has to get out of this conviction.
And we fight. We fight like hell. And if you don't fight like hell, you're not going to have a country anymore.
Dan, are there moments where you can tell the House managers are going to link on to this thing that President Trump said? Like, this is the damning piece of evidence that you think they could actually point to and say, come on, clearly this guy incited this thing.
Well, no, I think that the strongest argument the House managers can make is the totality of the circumstances. I mean, you know, fight like hell. Oh, okay, well, you know, their argument is he didn't mean literally fight, he meant figuratively fight. Okay, so the strongest argument the House managers can make is to set the stage for everything that happened, and it actually started happening before the election, right? This is President Trump setting the stage before Election Day that he was going to claim voter fraud if he didn't win.
It's nice, on November 3rd, you're watching and you see who won the election, and I think we're gonna do well because people are really happy with the job we've done. But you know what? We won't know. We might not know for months because these ballots are gonna be all over.
And that it got more and more aggressive as time went on.
This is an embarrassment to our country. We were getting ready to win this election. Frankly, we did win this election.
And then he goes and sets up this rally at the Capitol. And I think, look, I think it's going to be very important what they say about what happened that day, what President Trump did and didn't do.
I know your pain. I know you're hurt. We had an election that was stolen from us.
But to follow up election on something that Trish was saying, is that there's no question this is Trump's to lose, right? I mean, he's got the numbers.
Right.
Acquittal's
like a foregone conclusion unless something crazy happens.
Yeah, that's it. I mean, he has to do something insane to change the numbers. A witness or a statement or something that happens that would be completely unexpected to potentially change the outcome.
Yeah, you look up 4 weeks later, and a lot of this has actually been decided within the parties themselves. If anything, a lot of this evidence, a lot of these arguments are really for the American people, and then how to gauge the American people's reaction to living all this again. All right, Dan Abrams, Trish Turner, thank you.
My pleasure.
Thanks, Brad.
Next up on Start Here, 10% down, 90% to go. How to get the rest of America vaccinated after the break.
We've got the exclusive view behind the table. Every day, right after the show, while the topics are still hot, the ladies go deeper into the moments that make the view, the view. The Views Behind the Table podcast. Listen wherever you get your podcasts.
Hey, I'm Andy Mitchell, a New York Times bestselling author.
And I'm Sabrina Kohlberg, a morning television producer. We're moms of toddlers and best friends of 20 years.
And we both love to talk about being parents, yes, but also pop culture.
So we're combining our two interests by talking to celebrities, writers, and fellow scholars of TV and movies.
Cinema, really.
About what we all can learn from the fictional moms we love to watch.
From ABC Audio and Good Morning America, Pop Culture Moms is out now wherever you listen to podcasts.
The first ever criminal trial of a former president is underway in Manhattan. It's one of potentially four trials facing former President Trump as he makes his third bid for the White House. What do voters think about his culpability, and would a guilty verdict make a difference in the election? I'm Galen Druk, and every Monday and Thursday on the 538 Politics podcast, we break down the latest news from the campaign trail. We sort through the noise and zoom in on what really matters, using data and research as we go. That's 538 Politics every Monday and Thursday, wherever you get your podcasts.
At this moment, if you take 10 Americans at random, one of them has now gotten at least one dose of a COVID vaccine. We hit that 10% number yesterday, which is a big deal.
To get it this early, this quick, it's great.
For me, with my COPD, as bad as it is, I'm very lucky that I got in.
Just thrilled to death. I couldn't believe it. I feel so blessed.
But if you only get one dose of the currently authorized vaccines, that's only half the solution. In fact, if you don't get that second dose, there are new risks that can arise. So as a result, you've got states saying, hey, The new variant is taking off in this country. We need to get as many first doses administered as we can. But what happens if we give away too many second doses and their replacements never show up? That is the tricky dance that ABC's Eva Pilgrim has been tracking in real time. In fact, she's at a vaccine facility right now. Where are you, Eva?
I'm at Emergent BioSolutions. They are manufacturing the Johnson & Johnson vaccine.
This way?
Yeah, right here. So once the product is manufactured, it's filled in bottles.
Where the bottles look
like? It's like 10-liter bottles. They're square.
They're already making the vaccine here. Even though Johnson & Johnson hasn't gotten emergency use authorization at this point.
So we started back in the April, May timeframe. So at that point, we put a team together. We were hiring and training at the same time. For lack of a better analogy, we're driving a car and putting the wheels on at the same time.
And they actually started making the vaccine back in September, gearing up for when they get authorization, those early doses will be able to go out right away and get into the arms of people. And this is significant and really encouraging to see.
We're going to be making hundreds of millions of doses here out of this facility.
Because all of these doses are ready to go. And this vaccine is a one-dose vaccine. It also doesn't have to be stored at those crazy cold temperatures like the two vaccines we currently have available to us. They can actually put this in a refrigerator and transport it in a refrigerator, which will make it a lot easier to get to more remote areas, rural areas, on those mobile vaccine trucks that will go to communities where people don't have cars. It's really going to be potentially a game changer at getting the vaccine into the arms of people.
Well, and it reminds me, Eva, that the other two vaccines we've seen so far, they're two doses. We've seen concern about the distribution of, like, do you put the second dose in the circulation? Do you hold it back and make sure? What are the concerns if those vaccines don't arrive on schedule or if people don't get a second dose?
Dr. Fauci?
Thank you very much, Dr. Walensky. I'd like to address briefly two issues that have come up for discussion over the last several days.
Dr. Fauci raised a concern during the most recent COVID briefing.
The boost, either 21 or 28 days later, was tenfold higher. So it went, for example, from 1 to 100 to well over 1 to 1,000.
Saying basically they want to make sure people get that second dose because they don't want this virus to mutate in a way that circumvents that first dose.
We mean it covers not only the wild type and currently circulating virus, but also the variants that we see circulating.
Basically, if you think of this the same way that they talk to us all about antibiotics, when you get a prescription for an antibiotic, your doctor tells you to take it through the very end, even though you feel better. That's exactly what they're wanting to make sure. And people do, because if you don't take the antibiotics, then you have the potential for creating these super bugs.
If you get a suboptimum response, the way viruses respond to pressure, you could actually be inadvertently selecting for more mutants by a suboptimal response.
Dr. Fauci is reminding people that just because you got the first vaccine and you have some protection doesn't mean that you shouldn't go get the second vaccine. You need both doses to have the correct protection against the virus.
We've now been able to go out and talk with personally with the vaccine manufacturers. They've upped significantly the commitments to the amount of vaccine they'll produce and when it will be produced. Things are beginning to click.
And yesterday, President Biden was virtually touring a vaccine facility. He was essentially saying, look, we want 300 million doses administered by the end of the summer. We should be able to do that. But at the same time, he kind of signaled that governors are not necessarily even aware of how much help they need to make that happen in a timely manner, just because there are so many fits and starts with the supply right now. It's ramping up. In the meantime, several states once again loosening their restrictions because of those dips in positivity rates. Eva Pilgrim, thank you.
Thank you.
All right, I'm ready to drop in 5.
Every year, whenever we're talking about ski slopes and mountain climbers, you're going to hear about avalanches. And it's easy for an avalanche to get your attention, right? They can move up to 200 miles an hour. They can bury towns, and they can come from seemingly nowhere. Like, they're scary.
Next tonight, to the deadly avalanche threat. More than a dozen people killed in avalanches just this week.
But this year, for some reason, they might seem even scarier than usual.
In Utah, a wall of snow hitting Mill Creek Canyon's backcountry Saturday. Four skiers killed, another four rescued.
Recently, it's gotten to the point where we're hearing about a deadly avalanche every few days. But for a phenomenon that seems so random, is it really possible that in certain years, avalanches can be a bigger threat? We've called in ABC's chief meteorologist, Ginger Z, to help us out on this. Ginger, first of all, is it just me? Like, are there always this many avalanches and I'm just ignorant, or are we seeing more than usual?
We are seeing more avalanches and more avalanche deaths. Specifically this year, we just found out that we, within 1 week, had more deaths than we've seen in a century. And that's when you start to take notice. Now, that said, if you even look at last winter in Colorado, they had an epic year where they were taking out lanes of traffic. They do such a great job at mitigating avalanches in general that even the experts are being taken by surprise with how much the snow is moving.
There's been several small avalanches, and there's a car stuck between a couple of them.
And it's not just in the Rocky Mountains or the Cascades here in the U.S. There are several studies from the Himalayas to the Alps to around the world where we're seeing less stable snow on mountainsides.
Wait, so what is causing the uptick? Is there an actual reason, or is it just, like, I guess anything can set them off?
Hunter and I were playing in these trees.
Yes, anything can. And most of the time in these cases, it is a backcountry skier, snowboarder, snowmobiler.
I pulled my chute, didn't work. I heard Hunter yelling, and here he is. You okay, bud?
But are we seeing more?
A total of four individuals that we saw, two buried, possibly more, but two.
Hours earlier, another avalanche 80 miles away claimed the lives of four people, including 29-year-old Sarah Mogamian.
A lot of these people will tell you, I've been out every season, and I've never been caught in an avalanche. That's why this was shocking.
Her partner was able to save two people who were trapped, but was not able to save her.
They've done this kind of skiing and hiking for years now, and they've seen all types of avalanches.
So here's what I think could be happening, and there are several studies to support this. It could come down to a warming climate, climate change, more extremes happening more closely together. Because in climate change, you're going to have more moisture in a warmer atmosphere that can fuel more extreme snowstorms, which can mean bigger avalanches. You can have warmer temperatures, right, that then have the layers of snow that have accumulated, perhaps some of the bigger snow totals, and then you have rain on top of it, and that's going to make an unstable side of a mountain.
Different layers of snow and ice.
Yes.
Sergeant Cutler with Unified Police says everyone had an avalanche beacon. She says nobody should have been on the backcountry Saturday as avalanche risk was extremely high.
You know, I'm not sure if it's the thrill or what it is, but it's really important to pay attention to those things. There has been advisories out recently of the very high avalanche danger.
Like this last weekend, we knew there were going to be avalanches, or at least they were possible. There were avalanche warnings everywhere.
Is it also possible that, you know, the last 12 months have been so different as far as where people go, where they travel, where they vacation, how they live? Is it possible that either you have more instigators, more people exploring, or just more people at the bottom of the mountain putting themselves in a potentially deadly situation?
I mean, this is something that we fight in all parts of weather, I think, and in climate, is that, you know, if an avalanche happened in 1850, if there was no one there to see it, did we know that the avalanche happened? If there was no backcountry snowboarder that had a way of getting up there because of technology and can withstand amazing temperatures because we have outfits that you know, we can do that.
Right.
We're exploring more, especially during the pandemic. I think more people perhaps have more time.
A lot of veteran skiers are flocking here to the backcountry because of COVID restrictions at resorts this year. So with that in mind, they need to have a plan, including an avalanche beacon. I'm going to turn this on and show exactly how it works. Once it starts transmitting, if it's doing it correctly, this should switch from red to green.
But these are avoidable. Look at the forecast. Look at how stable that backcountry skiing or snowboarding is going to be.
I was going to say, decades of experience in getting ready for these things until the circumstances are changing around you. It can be a little more volatile. All right, Ginger Z, thanks so much.
Thank you.
And one last thing, when you talk to national security experts about hacking, they're often nervous about emails getting selectively leaked. They're kind of worried about big banking systems and personal information. But the scenario that really scares them is what would happen if a hacker ever got hold of our nation's infrastructure. Well, yesterday in Florida, officials confirmed a hacker got into a city's water system and seemed to try to contaminate the water.
The important thing is to put everybody on notice. And I think that's really the purpose of today, is to make sure that everyone realizes these kind of bad actors are out there.
A plant operator in the city of Oldsmar near Tampa said that on Friday morning he was looking at his screen when suddenly it was as if someone else had the mouse. He figured it must be a remote IT person. Nothing happened. A few hours later, though, the same user appeared to take control of his computer again.
One of the functions opened by the person hacking into the system was one that controls the amount of sodium hydroxide in the water.
Sodium hydroxide is lye, the stuff you find in soap and in drain cleaners.
It's a bad actor. This isn't just, we're putting a little bit of chlorine or a little bit of fluoride or a little bit of something. You're basically talking about lye.
Normally, there is a tiny trace amount of lye in your water, basically to counteract any metals from pipes. It's about 100 parts per million. Well, here, the hacker raised the level of lye from 100 to 11,000 parts per million. That is dangerous. Luckily, the water plant operator saw it immediately and just brought it right back down. The affected water never made its way to any actual residents. But this has freaked out officials.
You know, this type of activity and this type of hacking of critical infrastructure is not necessarily limited to just water supply systems. It can be anything. It could be sewer systems. It could be a whole variety of things.
The local sheriff seemed shaken up. Senator Marco Rubio called on the FBI to treat this as a national security matter because we've seen how vulnerable society can be when it doesn't trust public health systems. From traffic lights to electricity grids to water plants, we put our faith in these systems to help us, at least more than they hurt us.
As soon as the level is beyond what the system says it should be, an alarm goes off. In our case, our personnel happened to observe the person that was in the system.
The other thing it makes you think is, wow, thank you, water plant operator, for doing your job and remaining vigilant. Next time someone takes control of your cursor, don't just assume it's Joe from IT. That'd be the freakiest thing to watch I can imagine. Like, that would be, grab the red phone. This is not a drill. The call's coming from inside the water plant. We will keep you posted on the fallout of this on Twitter at StartHereABC. And hey, don't forget live coverage of the impeachment trial of President Trump today on abcnews.com or the ABC News app. I'm Brad Milkey. See you tomorrow.